Okay, tonight we are exactly 1 week away from Purim. 1 week from tonight will be Purim night, Monday night, and so therefore, in anticipation, we're going to take a pause from our weekly study of Parsha to get in on some studying of the Megillah, which is one of my most favorite Megillot, one of my most favorite sections of the Tanakh altogether. Okay, so the title is Gil Zester, Who Wears the Pants? We're going to see about that. But it wouldn't be a class of mine without a video. And one of our favorite topics, the gift that keeps on giving, is our good friend Michael Scott. So without further ado, let's bring in Michael Scott into the Megillah. How does that fit in? You're going to find out. Okay, so I'm going to shift over. We're going to do the share screen. Let's do a little. Let's see that. Oh, that's interesting. Hold on. I'm going to pause this.
More OU restrictions.
Can you guys see the video okay?
Well, you started, but we're not seeing anything.
Just it's dark.
Okay, ready?
Okay, go. Make a
Okay.
big screen.
Say! Yes, it is. I declare bankruptcy! Yes, it is true. I, Michael Scott, am signing up with an online dating service. Thousands of people have done it, and I am going to do it. I need a username, and I have a great one. Little kid lover. That way people will know exactly where my priorities are at.
5K means 5 kilometers, not 5,000 miles.
Man. Hey,
oh my God.
What are you doing? What are you doing?
Wait, you said
no, I didn't. Just,
oh my God.
Please. I feel very blessed. Guess what? I have flaws. What are they? Oh, I don't know. I sing in the shower. Sometimes I spend too much time volunteering. Occasionally I'll hit somebody with my car. So sue me. No, don't sue me. That's the opposite of the point that I am trying to make. Just hit me. You'll see.
I can't because just got a manicure, so.
Oh, queer. I, Queer Eye. That's a good show. Important show. Would I rather be feared or loved? Easy, both. I want people to be afraid of how much they love me. And I think I proved that today at the dojo. Here's what we're going to do. Why don't we go around and everybody, say a race that you are attracted to sexually. I'm Prison Mike. You know why they call me Prison Mike?
Do you really expect us to believe you're somebody
Do
else?
you really expect me to not push you up against the wall,
Oh, whoa, whoa.
biatch? It's just the way we talk in the clink. Pizza, great equalizer. Rich people love pizza, poor people love pizza. White people love pizza. Black people love pizza. Black people like pizza. Parkour! Parkour!
Make a right turn.
Wait. No. It means bear right. Not
No,
there.
it said right, so take a right.
No. Look, it means go up. To the right, bear right over the bridge and hook up with 307.
Make a right
Maybe it's a
turn.
shortcut, Dwight. It said go to the right.
It can't mean that. There's a light
Right,
there.
I think he knows where he's going.
This is the
The machine knows.
light. No. I am beautiful. They are beautiful. He is beautiful. This big fat. Big is beautiful.
I finally broke down and bought myself a plasma TV. check it out. I actually hung this on the wall myself.
It's good.
I want to show you something. A lot of people in the room. You need more space. Voila, right into the wall.
Wow.
Presents are the best way to show someone how much you care. It is like this tangible thing that you can point to and say, hey, man, I love you this many dollars worth.
Come on, Michael. You're interrupting.
You're hitting me. Come on. You say radon is silent but deadly, and then you expect me not to make farting noises with my mouth? What is this?
Sit down.
You know what? We're not going to die of radon. We're going to die of boredom.
Yeah.
Right? And if I had a gun with two bullets and I was in a room with Hitler, Bin Laden, and Toby, I would shoot Toby twice.
All right, we get the idea. All right, it's good enough.
And I have a great one.
All right. Anyway, so that's a sort of a greatest hits of Michael Scott. Here's a question. Question number one. What is the imposter syndrome? What is imposter syndrome? You guys familiar with that? Have you heard of that concept, imposter syndrome?
Like fake it till you make it?
No, not exactly. Similar. You're
always trying to like tailor yourself to your environment, to whoever like you're with, to like impress them, to make them be your friends.
That can be a result of imposter syndrome. Person becomes very needy and doing things to just constantly get everybody's validation and attention. That's not quite imposter syndrome.
Someone like Bernie Madoff, you know, he was like an imposter.
But he's just that's not imposter syndrome. That's just an imposter. Right. He's depicting himself as a successful investor when really he's leading the world in the largest Ponzi scheme ever. That's just an imposter. That's not a imposter syndrome. Has a very specific thing. Imposter syndrome is like this: a person has the skills and the talent to do a given job, but they feel internally that they are really not worthy of doing this job. So, and there's a psychological fear of being exposed as if they're really a fraud. They're an imposter on the job, that they are not qualified to do the job. Many people experience it. This is something that, for example, and it could be an internal factor, or it could be because of a societal factor. For example, women, or certainly people of color who take positions of, let's say, CEO, COO, very significant positions in a corporation, will oftentimes feel like, even though that they went to the best schools, they have a track record of being successful, but they have been sort of conditioned that a person of such yourself never has this kind of position, and therefore they feel that they are in there that. It's a mistake, really, and somebody's going to discover that the emperor has no clothes. So they feel constantly a sense of an anxiety of being outed, if you will, that they are really not the person that they are presenting themselves as. It's called imposter syndrome. Okay, now, so let us distinguish between what is a justified feeling of inadequacy versus an unjusted feeling of inadequacy. How would you differentiate that? What is it, a justified feeling of inadequacy or an unjusted feeling of inadequacy? So how do you know if a person, imposter syndrome or just in a certain sense an imposter?
I mean, I don't know. Sometimes when I'm talking to people in my line of work that are like incredibly accomplished or have a lot of power,
yep.
I don't feel like I should be in that category of with them. Like, I don't feel like, because I'm younger, because I don't have a lot of experience, but yet I'm in this position where I'm dealing with a lot of high, powerful people that I just don't really feel comfortable.
So the question is, So the question is that feeling of inadequacy justified or unjustified? Reality or fantasy?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of both, right? Because if Hashem has placed me in this position, in this job for a reason, that is my role, and I may still feel that way because I don't have necessarily the time spent in the political realm. But yet I'm still in this position that I'm in dealing with these people.
Right. Well, so, I mean, okay. So that's so a person can be, in other words, this goes back to you, what you said before, fake it until you make it. For example, they have there was a social science study done at when men versus women applying for jobs. When a job says they list the requirements for the job, the basic thing is that it said that women will not even apply for a job unless they're over 80% of the stated qualifications. While guys, if they're like at over 40%, yeah, we'll make it happen. You know what I mean? Sometimes there is ignoring of being inadequate, and then there is an unjustified. In other words, what the trend among women are that they, unless they're absolutely hitting every single box, they feel very, very nervous. They're nervous about being an imposter, while guys don't have the experience, don't have the skill set. Yeah, I'm gonna go for it. That's it. We're gonna do it. So obviously there's a range over here. So yeah. There are legitimate feelings of inadequacy. Like, you know, there are parts of this job that I feel that I really can't do well, and I'm weirdly having to do the job. That's A. Versus, you have all the skills, you have the experience, you have the training, but it's really a psychological force, an internal part of you saying, you're not worthy, you're not capable, you can't do it, you shouldn't be here, you're fooling people, you're taking their money, it's unjustified, you're a scammer, you're a hustler. You know, these negative self-talk of criticism. Undermine your position in the job. So now, here's a question relevant to our video of our good friend Michael Scott. Did he suffer from a justified feeling of inadequacy or an unjustified feeling of inadequacy? He's constantly trying to cope and overcompensate by doing like ridiculous things to try to
unjustified, because I mean, is he
inadequate based upon his decision making and his whatever? Obviously, it's a comedy, but. Is he really qualified to be the person for the job?
Well, I mean, technically, in the show, like his office is one of the top sales, you know, offices of
fine.
All
but
of
that, that, that means doing but, something but that, right. But that could be not because he is a good manager, it's because he's fortunate to have great employees that make him look good. I think the plot of the whole series is that he is woefully inadequate. He makes crazy decisions, and since he's afraid that people are gonna he's gonna be out as being wildly unqualified for the job, he does these crazy, you know, like we saw, like there's a Toby's doing a training session. He'll go out. He needs to steal the show. He needs to be in charge. He needs to get all the attention. It's 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 an overcompensation, the fact that he feels so inadequate. You know what I'm saying? So he's always doing and that, of course, makes him look what? Even more, in other words, he's trying to hide his inadequacy, but when he overcompensates, he just reveals it to everybody in a greater way. He'll say something racist. He'll say something wildly inappropriate. Whatever. Because he doesn't have all the parts. You know what I mean? He doesn't have the emotional intelligence. And that, of course, that's why that movie was, that's why that series was such a hit for, I don't know, a decade? 11 years? I don't know, 12 years? I don't even know how many years. Great many years.
Rabbi Penny, if I may make an observation, it's actually an interesting conversation to have because to explore the whole concept of perception of reality and how you perceive yourself, you also acknowledge our ability to perceive ourselves in at least some manner as we are perceived by others. So then the question becomes, everyone else, every single person looks through the world through their own lens, and everyone's lens is different.
Yes.
So how do we gauge ourselves without having that emotional intelligence and connection to others? So our baseline is not off, because there's always areas that every single person can improve on. I think the Torah is very clear on that. We all have our strengths and our weaknesses, and that's how we're designed. And that's all part of the tikkun, but the way that I think that we think that others perceive us in a large part encourages certain actions, but then sometimes you make the decision to do things and then don't recognize that what you're doing is not socially acceptable.
Correct. So that is a we're gonna get into that tonight, because the star of the show is Achashverosh. And we're going to do a deep dive into his personality. We're going to deal with some of the scenarios that Shaul directly deal with that exact point. But ultimately, that is not that we'll give some insights into that. But how one gets better in that is a complex process. You know what I'm saying? So we're going to learn some of the principles. We're going to give some scenarios to define. We're going to see that in our main character, Achashverosh, and is dealing with his wife Vashti, but being able to understand that in our own personal lives and transcend that's as you said, that's a tikkun, that's real work, real self work. Sometimes a person can do it themselves in part, and sometimes they do it with friends, and sometimes they need actually a trained therapist to give them guidance on that. It's not a simple thing. It's a complicated. You're touching upon a very complex thing. Our goal tonight is to touch upon this area of self-perception, actual inadequacies, perceived inadequacies, how to navigate between the two. Obviously, the fake it till you make it approach, and then when is it you're going too far. That's we're going to jump in. That's going to give us a lens to be able to appreciate in a deeper way what's happening in the beginning part of the Megillah. We will apply to some cases at the end, but what you're talking about is a vast area. So let's say we're going to begin tonight. We'll just do it like that. We're going to begin tonight. It's a juicy topic. All right, Shane Avakasha, read us in. I'm going to share a screen. We're going to read the Parsha. We're not the Parsha. I'm sorry, the Megillah. This is already talking about. He has already begun the. Already have at the third year of Achashverosh's reign, he has a 180-day party for his dignitaries, officials throughout his 127 province empire, the Persian Empire. And then he makes a 7-day feast for the locals, the people of his capital city of Shushan. Shall I read it out, starting with Pasuk number 5.
And when these days were complete, the king made a feast for all the people who were present in Shushan the castle, from great to small, 7 days in the courtyard of the garden of the king's house. White, fine cotton, and blue, fastened with cords of fine linen, and purple to silver rods and marble pillars. Couches of gold and silver upon a floor of alabaster, marble, pearl, and black onyx. and he gave them to drink in golden vessels, vessels of all different types, and the royal wine was in abundance, in accord with the king's power. And the drinking was according to the law. There was no coercion, for so the king had instituted that all the officers of his house should do according to every man's desire.
Let's pause also, right there. All right, so let's pause right there. Let's just, so what's going on here is that Ahasuerus is trying to, on one level, consolidate power. And insofar as, like the mafia says, you hold your enemies close and your friends closer. So Ahasuerus, always fearful, as you see later on in the Megillah, fearful of assassination or insurrection. He's not just paranoid. Therefore he makes a big 7-day party for the locals, and he shows them a fine time. He brings out, they obviously have the part of like the backyard, the gardens of the royal palace in Shushan are all decked out with all these golden hangings. There's, of course, now obviously there's food, but the focus of the thing is abundance of wine. We're having a wine fest. And what's the rules of the wine party, of this wine, for what they call in Hebrew a mishteh? What is the rule of the wine party? There's one rule which we're going to circle back to. The Gemara focuses upon that.
Drink as much as you can.
You can do that. But it's
no coercion.
No coercion. So what does that mean?
That everyone can choose how much or how little they want to drink.
Exactly. The idea is that you could be there and just have a little bit of wine or no wine, or you could drink as much as you want. The idea was everybody can have whatever they want, and there's kirtzon ish v'ish, the pasuk says. Okay, now let's pick it up on verse number 9. Yeah, take it away.
Also, Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house of King Ahasuerus. On the 7th day, when the king's heart was merry with wine, he said to Mehuman, Bista, Charvona, Bigta, and Avagta, Zetar, and Charkas, the 7 eunuchs who served King Ahasuerus, to bring Vashti the queen before the king in the royal crown, to show the people and the officers her beauty, for she was beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's word conveyed by the eunuchs, and the king was very angry, and his wrath burned within him. The king said to the wise men who knew the times, for so was the king's custom to consult with all who knew law and judgment, according to law, what shall we do to Queen Vashti, since she has not done the bidding of King Ahasuerus conveyed by the eunuchs? Memuchan answered before the king and the officers, not against the king alone has Vashti the queen sinned, but also against all the officers and all the peoples that are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's word will go out to all the women, causing them to view their husbands with contempt, saying, King Ahasuerus said to bring Vashti the queen before him, but she did not come. And this day, the noble woman of Persia and Media, who heard the queen's word, will say likewise to all the king's officers, and there will be more than enough scorn and anger. If it pleases the king, let a royal edict go forth from him, and let it be written among the laws of Persia and Media that it not be revoked, that Vashti not come before King Ahasuerus, and that the king give her royal crown to another that is better than she.
Okay. All right. So, okay. So we have the great incident. And obviously, if Chazal understood that if the queen's crown is being given to somebody else, what's happening to Vashti doesn't overtly say it in the verse.
She's being executed.
Correct. Correct. Because basically in the tyrannical world of the Persian Empire, no, that woman is no longer available. And the way to make her no longer available means basically to she and her head will be separated. OK, so. All right. So anyways, so basically, just as a review, we have a 7-day party. In other words, Ahasuerus and the guys of Shushan are out in the grounds of the palace. Inside, Vashti's having her own party. 7th day, when it says, when the king was merry with wine. Okay. He asked the seven eunuchs. Eunuchs means that these are men that have been altered, so they do not have a sexual desire, to go into the woman's party and ask our good friend Vashti to walk down the runway in front of the men of Shushan for everybody's enjoyment to appreciate her fine beauty. Okay? She refuses, and of course, a crisis ensues. Basically, all right, what are you going to do with her? Mamukhan says, she's not just insulting you. She's insulting she's going to cause a big Shalom Bayis crisis in the entire empire. And basically, if the queen does not have to listen to her king, the husband, no, all the women are going to be in absolute revolt. All right. Okay, that was his argument. Now, question number one. In what way was having a royal party for all the common folk of Shushan a typical Michael Scott move, seeking to make everyone afraid of how much they loved him?
I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's not like people wanted to be there. It's like the king requested this party and you go because you're scared of the repercussions. That's kind of Michael Scott. He'll throw a party and everyone has to go because it's at work and people don't want to be at a Michael Scott party.
Exactly. Right. Now, and now is he, now what does Michael Scott believe of people at the party?
That everyone loves him because they're all there.
Right. See, that's proof. Look how many friends I have. They're all there. They love being there. Meanwhile, they're there because they love their job. They don't want to be fired. So Ahasuerus is basking. You know, he needs their approval. So he needs to. That's why, endless food, endless drink. He's just trying to make everybody love him. You know, he needs everybody to love him. Michael Scott right, he's always
everyone's terrified of him. So that's correct. Why they're there.
But he's oblivious to that. He doesn't want to accept. He doesn't want to. He doesn't. Going back to Scholl's point, it's a reality about himself he does not want to see. He wants them to believe that he has an adoring crowd. He's hanging out with the boys. It's the seventh day. Chazal have an argument. They're having an argument. Who is the most beautiful woman? Are they from Babylonia? Are they from Persia? And he says, I'll settle it because my wife, Vashti, she's Persian. And we'll have her walk the runway and we'll prove this important conversation about where are the most beautiful women found from, what area, what country. Okay. How much would Ahasuerus have been feeling his imposter syndrome anxiety on the seventh day of drinking with the boys as the king's heart was merry with wine? Is he feeling that he's an imposter on the seventh day when his heart is merry with wine? Joel, you are muted.
I said it really depends if he's a tzaddik or not. I think there's definitely probably a level of a little bit of merriness that a king needs to have with the men, but it's the reason that the officers don't hang with the enlisted men, because it messes with the respect dynamic.
Correct.
So there's a balance.
So that's true, but is he feeling, is he, in other words, if Ahasuerus, who is a new king, this is the third years of his reign, we're going to get into it, is he feeling his anxiety that he's an imposter by day seven?
Absolutely, because he has to show off his wife. Like a king who is like sure of themselves, you don't bring in the wife to take away attention away from you. Like you are the king.
True. So but he's not feeling nervous because he's a little drunk. In fact, the number one reason.
Right. It's liquid courage.
Alan said nicely. Or imagine a bunch of guys or a bunch of girls are going to the club, right? And everybody, that could be a socially awkward social situation. So a person goes there to have, a glass of liquid courage, as Alan said, avoid the to remove the anxiety. Well, the problem when you remove the anxiety quickly comes into stupidity. So you know you're gonna pour yourself a glass of regret. So all right, let's keep on going. Why would the experience of the king's heart married with wine lead a Michael Scott persona to need to show off his king, his queen? What are the, in other words, he didn't tell her, in other words, if important, he didn't show her off on the first day. It was only on day seven when he's been drinking for 7 days. If like Michael Scott, Ahasuerus, which I'm asserting have a similar quality, basically having really not truly having sensing that they are not really qualified for the job. In other words, the job of being the king of the entire Persian Empire, that's a big job. That's a lot of responsibility. You got to be pretty smart for that. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest, we're going to see the Gemara in a moment, that's suggesting that he knows that he has lacks. He's not really up for the job. He has, shall we say, some skill deficits, okay? But he likes being the king. So what happens, why would the drinking bring out the need to show off the queen?
Drunk mind speaks sober heart.
Say that again, Shaul.
Drunk minds speak sober hearts.
Right. So, okay, you want to unpack that aphorism to this situation?
Rabbi, I think you're probably a lot wiser man than me. because when you've had a couple to drink, the true person comes out. I mean, I think I've heard a lot of shears and a lot of rabbis. I mean, the agreement is when the filter is removed, you show who you really are.
Correct. Chazal, just the Talmudic corollary to that is Nichnas Yayin. Actually, that's the Pasuk in Mishlei. Nichnas Yayin, Yotzei Sod. The wine enters, and out comes the secrets. Okay? So, which means that that he's feeling very inadequate, he's feeling low, so therefore he has to really, up the game by displaying, the most beautiful woman to show that he's trying to assert he's a man. Look at my arm candy. He's like pulling up to the club with a Lamborghini and just parking right in front and coming out with a model, draped by his arm. Because it was a gesture of absolute weakness and inadequacy that he needs their validation. Here we go. Question number four. Would someone of true royal lineage like Queen Vashti? And I'm gonna go back to this. I'm going to go back to question four. I want to introduce you to the Gemara here. So, Shane of Avakasa, read the Gemara here.
The verse continues, therefore the king was very wrathful, and his anger burned in him. Why did his anger burn in him so greatly? Rava said, she sent him. You son of my father's stableman, Ahur Yareh, my father drank wine against 1,000 men and did not become inebriated. And that man, referring to Ahasuerus, has become senseless from his wine. Immediately, his anger burned in him.
Okay, so the Gemara is commenting. It says that he got angry and his anger burned in him. It was like a double language. So what did, and apparently she didn't just simply, according to the Gemara, she didn't simply refuse. She sent him a message. And what was her message? What was from the Gemara, from the Agadita? What was the midrashic message that Vashti basically sent to Ahasuerus?
He's a fool.
There's a double barbed message there. She hit them with a two-fisted attack. What's her uppercut?
She calls him son of my father's stableman.
Okay, so basically, Vashti, according to the Gemara, Vashti was of royal lineage, while Ahasuerus was a usurper. He came to royalty through, not through, through, he was born into it. as he says, you are the son of my father's stable boy. In other words, a stable boy, guys in charge of the horses, is not a very significant position in the royal court. And you are the son of it. So basically, what is she basically calling him? In a simple word.
Low class. I mean,
you're a loser.
No.
You're all right. You're not. You're asking me to come out. You're a fake king. You're the son of my father's stable boy. And then she hits him, but that's not alone. Then she hits him with another one. And what does she say? My father, aka the real king, what was he able to do?
He was able to drink even more than this and did not become drunk.
He could hold his liquor. The phrase is true today. People have that phrase. He can hold his liquor like a man, right? There's a feature of manliness until 2023. This already goes back. So we're talking about an idea that seems to span thousands of years. A measure of a power of the man is the ability to drink and not get drunk. My father drank wine with 1,000 men, did get drunk, and you're already drunk. So basically saying, not only you're a loser and you're inadequate to be here, you're a wussy. You can't hold your liquor. You're a baby. So she completely shamed him on double A. You're a man of no rank. You're not an imposter syndrome. You are actually an imposter. A. And B, you don't got the goods. Because a real king would be able to drink for 7 days as part of dealing with the running a royal party, and would keep his mind together, would not be affected by the alcohol. So she completely humiliated him. And that's why the Gemara says, not only did he get angry for the refusal, he actually was, his anger was burned because now what did, now why were those two barbs that she threw at him so powerful? Why did he go crazy at that point? This is a very important point of interpersonal relationships. He went crazy because of that. What's going on here? You got to know something about relationships here. Husband-wife relationships. Why was this so powerful? Why did she get him? Okay. So the concept is that if you have any husband, wife, or good friends, person who has a long-term relationship with a person knows their absolute vulnerabilities. And Vashti, who is clearly a smart woman, knows precisely where the soft underbelly of Ahasuerus. He knows he is not of the royalty class to be a king. He knows he's not an imposter syndrome, an imposter on that level. Two, she's also demeaning him. You're not a king, you're not even a man. I mean, basically, she essentially verbally castrates the guy. Okay? Basically, So now, with that background, let's go to question number four. Why would someone of true royal lineage like Queen Vashti find it particularly demeaning to feel her husband's need to be loved at this moment?
Because that's the Torah position. And even the Goyim of understanding and Bina understand how you have to conduct yourself, and you don't do those types of things in public to other people.
Well, 1 second. Do we imagine that Queen Vashti is a very sneeze woman? She's a woman of the highest level of modesty and decency? Should we assume that? Where is she, by the way? Where is, remember, what's the scene? Remember, there's two parallel parties going on. Inside the palace is Vashti with all the women. She's at the head of the table. Outside right, in the gardens is Ahasuerus. He's on top of it, you know, in front of all the guys. What's really happening here?
Also, because she's true royalty, she's going to conduct her way with Sneas, and like that she doesn't, I don't know. I just, the vision of Game of Thrones comes to me. It's like while the townsfolk are all partying and debauchery, the royalty is seen as like from anointed from God. So there's like a holiness to the kingdom, to the royalty. And I think she's trying to encompass that. And her husband is partying like with the pagans.
Exactly. In other words, she's a dignified, true, you know, she was a princess, that's now the queen. So she's a dignified person. It's not so much a Sneas issue, that she's and now you're making me be like a call girl to walk down the runway so a bunch of drunken guys can look at me, you know, ogle at me. Okay. And not only that, she has to leave her party when she is holding forth in charge of all the women. You know what I'm saying? So it's a double, it's an extremely, what do you call it? It's an extremely shaming experience what he's asking her to do. And that's why she demeans him, because, you know, you're a son of my father's stable boy. So, you know, the fact that you're asking shows you that you're not, it's like she's giving him a smack. So, and that's why Ahasuerus is very vulnerable, because what was Ahasuerus trying to accomplish with 180 days of partying with all the aristocrats and the 7 days of partying with all the people of Shushan? What was his singular goal? What was he trying to accomplish?
I mean, he was trying to shore up alliances because he's a new king.
Yes. And everybody should look at him in what way?
As the king, and they should fear him because he has total control.
And what does, by Vashti refusing, what has she done in one fell swoop?
Saying that, pretty much said that he doesn't have the power because she's refusing him.
He's trying to say, I control the 127 provinces of Persia. And she's saying, you don't even control your house. You can't even control your wife. So he basically, she exposed, because she was mortified by this request as being a woman of great dignity. It was a power struggle, and she viewed him as being a person of low of rank. And I'm not gonna give in to this commoner, okay? And this exposed him. His whole 6 month parting of people coming in and out of all the aristocrats, showing he's a powerful king. He should be feared, as Alan pointed out. And what did she said? No, will you fear this guy? He can't even get his wife to show up. Guy's a complete loser. So she devastated him. Now, but you can ask the question back. Question number six. Why would Vashti risk rejecting the tyrant's request? Isn't that crazy? How does being in front of friends and drink complicate the matter? In other words, it may be true that he is the son of her father's stable boy, but he's still the king. And he does have power, and he has an army, and why is she saying no? Isn't that kind of crazy?
I mean, maybe she thinks she can refuse him and nothing will happen. Because she's royal, because she is this royalty, and maybe she thinks that he needs her more than she needs him.
Ah, that's it. So it's a power. That's He'll come to his senses. He'll wake up. And then he recognizes because he's nothing. Or she thinks, you know, she overplayed her cards. She basically says, he's nothing without me. I give him validation.
The legitimacy.
Ah, he gives me legitimacy. I give his empire legitimacy. And be an bottom line is also when she for her to walk out and have to go walk the runway, and all the women are going to know about it because that's not going to not get out. Guy's going to for sure get out. People when you're under a lot, she's under a lot. They're under both a lot. They put themselves in a lot of pressure. He made this announcement that he's got to deliver in front of his staff, and now he's being exposed that he's a weakling. And she's going to be reduced. Instead of being the mighty Queen Vashti, she's basically asked to walk down the runway like a stripper, which of course is humiliating for Vashti the Queen. Okay, so therefore she gambled. She put all her chips on number seven, and as Emma Mukhan said, "Sorry, honey, you're losing." All right, let's go to another Midrash. Okay, before I go into this, here's my question to you both. This is sort of a methodology question. Did Vashi actually send the message that Rava articulated? Why or why not? This is more
Well,
of a question. This is how to learn a Gemara. Did she actually say all these words that Rava said?
she never showed up to the party, so
Well,
how
let's
would
look. Well, the verse says, but Vashti refused to come to King's word conveyed by the eunuchs. Just says he refused. So the plain text is she just said no. Rava in the Gemara says, "You son of my father's stableman, my father drank wine against 1,000 men, did not become inebriated, and that man has become senseless from his wine. Immediately, his anger burnt in him."
So,
Did
but
she
so,
actually say? Did she actually say those words?
no.
So how do? So what? What? So what? How did Rava know this? She didn't say it. So why is Rava? Why is Rava making up the words then? Rava's a great Amora. Why is Rava the great Talmudic sage saying that she said this? And you got to tell me she didn't say this. So what's going on here?
Rava's trying to explain or give a reason as to what possibly could have been said for Ahasuerus to react and for Memuchan to react the way they did.
Exactly, because they're picking up on that the king got angry, very wrathful, and his anger burned in burned in him, or he was like doubly, he was like super hopping mad. So even if
It
she
also
said
provided.
no, or even if she just said the word "I'm not coming," but what Rav is giving you is an explanation. He's giving you a literary understanding of her no was not just simple no. In that no. Or sometimes there's a what you call it's like a the miss there's a message in the message, okay?
No
And
can
she,
mean a thousand things.
correct. And he understood full well what that no meant. Rava is basically he's helping us by using his, the Rava is explaining it. It's as if she said in explicit terms all these things, okay? He's giving you a Midrashic understanding to understand the story behind the story. Get what I'm saying? He's allowing us to read between the lines. What I'm sharing with you tonight is that there is an art of reading a Midrash, whether it's found by a Rashi or found in the Talmud. By the way, the official term when the Midrash is quoted in the Gemara is called an Agadata. Okay? That's a higher level midrash. It's more authoritative. So this is an authoritative midrash in the Gadata. So what Rava is teaching us is that you have to understand. It's not simply she said no. No. You have to understand. There's a whole power dynamic going on here, and to try to get you into the power of this exchange, even though very few words are being said, the meaning is a lot, okay? Very important. Now, I want to get to We're going on. All right, so let's get to this, another midrash. Alan, read it out. Esther Rabbah. Let's get another midrash in tonight.
To do as every man desired, the Holy One, blessed be He, said, "I do not nullify the wishes of all."
I do not fulfill. I do not fulfill.
Sorry, fulfill the wishes of all my creatures, and you seek to do as every man desired. The way the world.
So stop right there. So stop right there. So, because going back to the party, that the rule that Ahasuerus set out is that the maitre d's, whoever's in the party, should be involved, is that give everybody whatever they want. So the midrash says God himself criticized that. I don't give everything. I don't fulfill all the wishes of my creatures. And you want to fill all the wishes? Go on. Let me give three examples. Go on.
The way of the world is that if two men seek to marry one woman, can she marry them both? Rather, it is either to one or to the other. Likewise, if two ships were waiting in harbor, one seeking a north wind and one seeking a south wind, can one of the wind propel both of them together? Rather, it is either for one or the other. Tomorrow, two people will come before you for judgment, a Jewish man and an adversary and an enemy. Can you satisfy both of them? Rather, you elevate one and hang the other.
Okay. So the Gemara, so the Midrash here says, God explains to him, what do you mean take care of everybody's wishes? If you have two men that want one woman, can they both be married to her? No, it's either one or the other. If you have two ships, one needs a north wind, one needs a south wind, can they all be set sail the same time? No, it's either one or the other. And again, if you have Haman and Mordechai coming here, can they both work collectively? Can they work? Can you come before you in judgment? Can you satisfy them both? No, either one's going to go up, one's going to be exalted, and one's going to be hung, one or the other. So here's question A, very important. Why do you think that Ahasuerus wanted to fill the wishes of each person at the party? Why do you want to fill everybody's wishes?
Well, to get them to like him.
Exactly. He's very needy. Like we said, he's Michael Scott-esque. He's very needy. He needs everybody to love him. So therefore, he is he's bending over backwards to satisfy everybody, when in reality, it's going to cause conflict. Why does the Midrash use Hashem as giving criticism of Ahasuerus?
It's interesting because Hashem is not in the Megillah at all. So
there you go. Good.
It's interesting. This is like a conversation to show that Hashem actually is involved in this whole situation.
In what way?
In the way that he is going to be elevating Mordechai and Esther, and judging Haman and Ahasuerus.
That Ahasuerus is going to basically hang one and elevate the other.
But it shows that Hashem's still in control, and giving criticism that, like, hey, this isn't the way to do things. You can't be all to everyone.
Yes, it is fundamentally unnatural. It is not natural. In other words, just like you can't have two people marrying the same woman, you can't have two ships that need to go in opposite directions and need opposite winds. That's not what that is what basically what Hashem has brought in, because, as you said, Hashem runs the world, and he runs the world in a certain way. And you can't have a north wind and a south wind simultaneously. It does not work. So it basically showing the sort of like the insanity. In other words, Ahasuerus' need to be loved by everybody is causing him to do contradictory and destructive activities. And it's not right. Going to work. And it's just not going to work.
And it's against Hashem's kind of rules of nature.
Exactly. Exactly. It's that what the Midrash is pointing out, that the way that Ahasuerus was running part of his government was literally against Hashem's rule of the law of the natural order. Okay, With these ideas, I want to give three scenarios going back to what Shaul requested at the beginning, and these go to some of the takeaways, practical takeaways from the Megillah to practical everyday life. Here we go. Your MG here has a friend named Stacy. Stacy got in a horrible fight with their shared friend Miriam over trivialities. Stacy comes to Shira with her anger burning within her. Shira immediately knows that Stacy will expect her to be an absolute ally in this fight and join in on a Lashon Hara fest against Miriam. Shira feels a strong urge to please Stacy and avoid her anger in being disappointed. What would Mordechai advise and what would Achashverosh advise? What do you guys say? I'll start off easier. What would Achashverosh advise?
I mean, go ahead. Lashon Hara fest everything. Because it's to whatever one's
opinion. Yeah, because she wants to, Shira wants Stacy to love her. And she doesn't want to disappoint her. So she'll basically allow Stacy to throw Miriam under the bus, and okay, that's it. I'll deal with the fallout of this some other day. Okay. What would Mordechai say to her?
Good luck trying to get the base of Mikdash rebuilt.
Okay, yes. But he would say, look, just because Stacy is very, very upset and she wants her to back you up doesn't mean that what she's saying is correct. And you can't throw your other friend under the bus because, Stacy happens to be upset now. You say she got to figure out a way to diffuse the situation, calm her down. Look, you can say to Stacy, you can say to Shira can say to Stacy, look, Stacy, I know you're very upset. We've all been very upset. But, you know, and I know that you think that Miriam has really wronged you in some very important way. But realize that you're upset now. I guarantee you that you'll feel a little bit different tomorrow. And maybe we should talk about this. Maybe, you know, I'm sure you have some good points, but maybe she has some good points as well. You know what I'm saying? And being that Miriam was your friend for so many years, I'm sure, you know, what you're saying here is not, you know, shall we say, perhaps the whole story. You know, try to find to neutralize her anger and try to deal with it instead of just yes-yesing her because you don't want to deal with any kind of, you don't want to have the, develop the backbone to be able to deal with any kind of, friend who's upset with you. Many people don't want to, you know, they love their friends because they want them to be their cheerleaders and they don't want to upset them by being, you know, critical at all with them ever. Nothing to do with the foolish way. They just can't handle it.
Yeah.
All right. Scenario number two. Dave MG here is at the MG Purim party. Right there. Purim party at the Gem Saloon. Coming up this Thursday. Later in the party, when everybody's heart is merry with wine, that will happen. Dave overhears his ex-girlfriend Shoshana talking about him disparagingly to a circle of girls within his earshot. Dave has the perfect put down that he knows will devastate Shoshana. What would Vashi tell him to do? What would Esther tell him to do?
Vashi would say, let the tongue roll.
Let the tongue roll. Take that chick down. She, well, you know, because she's taunting you. She is trash talking about you, knowing that you can hear to other girls at the party. She's got to pay for that. You take her to Pound Town. She's got to hit the cement, right? So now, what would Esther say to her? What would Esther say to Dave?
She'd be more strategic, right? She'd kind of, you know, sit back, relax, like, you know, wait for your moment.
So, but should she, should Dave be taking revenge against his ex-girlfriend Shoshana?
No.
Now,
Now,
but
should
if
he
he
talk to
gives her enough
should
to
he
make
talk to
Shoshana look
Shoshana
crazy.
about him? Should he talk to Shoshana about her embarrassing him?
Yeah, definitely. Like, no, privately.
Yes, but maybe not tonight at the party.
When everyone's drunk.
But everybody's drunk and acting, they say, you know, he got a speech. I said, look, you know, he has to speak to her. And, you know, Esther would say, because Esther had many things to say about Ahasuerus. She never said a word. She only talked bad about Haman, even though that he had a genocidal decree against her whole people, at the end of the second party, at the right time, when it was for a reason. We only say something negative about a fellow, another person, if it's for a reason. So Dave has to wait, bide his time. He's got to suck it up, and he's got to talk to Shoshana. I said, look, you've got to have the conversation. Shoshana, look, Shoshana, I know we're not going out. I know that we broke up, and I know and obviously it did not work out. But I want to tell you that I felt very embarrassed when you were talking about me, about our personal life together, to other girls at the party. It just made me feel bad. I don't know what the value was, and I happen to notice that you did it when I was nearby. So obviously there was a goal for me to hear. I know. So if you're upset at me, I understand. But why do you have to go, you know, harshing me to others in the community? I, you know, felt very bad about that.
Especially if he's trying to date any of those girls.
Right. The goal, guys, the goal of the MJE, Dem Saloon Purim, pre-Purim party, is for young Jewish men and young Jewish women to meet each other in a spirit of Purim. Period. Okay. All right. And also, and perhaps continue to come to MG for other opportunities to find their Besher. Okay. That is a very not thinly hidden, that's not a very hidden plan of ours. Okay. We're, you know, and meanwhile, this Shoshana is, you know, really, egregiously harshing him. You know what I mean? Basically killing, you know, poison, as they said, this is an equivalent of, this is the proverbial poisoning the well. Okay. All right. We move on to the last scenario. Scenario number three. Debbie Amzer has made so many shalach manot. Those are gift packages. Mitzvahs, they have at least one basket with two different kinds of foods to one friend. Okay. But she made many. Is so happy to give them to all her friends. On Purim, a friend drops off a shalach manos to her, and she did not have her on her shalach manos list. Bum, bum. She feels terrible. Quickly assembles a ragtag regifting shalach manos to save face. It ruins her whole for Purim. All her efforts of shalach manos making and delivering seems like nothing. What would the Midrash say to her?
She completed the mitzvah. She only had to do two friends.
But what's her, but what, all right, sure, one friend, two gift, two foods to one friend.
Yeah.
All right, so
Matanot
Shayna,
Lev Yomim is one thing to each of two people.
what? Yeah. So, but what would the? But what's going on here? First of all, why is she? Why does she feel her whole Purim is ruined? What was she trying to accomplish with her Shalach Manos
I
campaign?
mean, she was trying to like be like Ahasuerus and like give to everyone to get them to like her, and it's not really about that.
So you're saying it was basically a a personal marketing campaign for everybody to feel that
Right. It's
she's
like around the winter holidays, you got to give gifts to like all your different bosses in order for them to remember you for bonus time.
there you go. So she's trying to curry favor with everybody. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, that's one possibility, but. But also, there could be an internal perfectionistic thing. If she's like, I'm going to give Shalach Manos, And I'm going to be the, you know, I'm going to make all my, because there is about, Shalkhmon is about creating a spirit of friendship among all the community. So giving Shalkhmonos to people that you have a relationship with is a good thing. But she got perfectionistic about that. That the fact that she gave 57 Shalkhmonoses and everybody was happy, but she left off, let's call her Nancy. And Nancy shows up and gives her a dramatic Shalkhmonos, and she gives her a off-the-cuff ragtag regifting Shalkhmonos. It's always funny. Some people actually get their Shalkhmonos back. You know what I mean? People like will reprocess the Shalkhmonos that they get, put them together, and you might get your Shalkhmonos back. So it's a funny thing. Anyways, now, Prickle, practically she should learn. Number one, is always have some spare Shalkhmonos on the ready. Don't give them all out. Keep some backup, because there's always going to be that person that you don't expect. You're not going to be caught shorthanded, number one. And number two is that the Midrash is like saying, that's not the way of the world. That's it. You're doing the best you can. You can't be perfectionistic. And she has to look, this goes back to what Shaul's question was at the beginning, is that she has to have a little conversation with herself. You had a great Purim. You're able to share the Purim joy with 57 of your friends. The fact that one friend came and you weren't able to give them the deluxe shalchmas that you'd worked on, well, that really reflects that maybe your sense of self and dignity needs work. That you feel so needy that if one person didn't get it, or that sense of that your perfectionistic is so marred, it shouldn't ruin your whole Purim. That itself is a opportunity to better understand yourself and grow to the next level. Nobody, as was said, nobody's perfect. You have friends. You're kind to your friends. You're doing Purim well. Okay, you didn't get you left somebody off the list. Okay, you're a busy person. You're allowed. And it's not like they didn't give him anything. You gave him a shalchmas. It was it the best shalchmas? It was not the best shalchmas. Is she going to think about it too much? No. We tend to think about catastrophize. Think about what our friends are thinking about way more than they are, because most people are thinking about themselves. They're not thinking about the other people as much as we think about them. So it's a personal anxiety that a person should think about, and that she could really use the opportunity to transcend and have an epiphany of self-awareness about what is really moving her internally. And therefore, she could become a stronger, more self-aware and healthier person. So Achashverosh was not the reason why he had to have top, he's surrounded by top aides, is because he felt very, very anxious because he knew that he had all these deficits. So he tried to, as a coping mechanism, had all, you know, he had all these various chachamim, he had Haman, of course, telling him what to do. He was surrounded by aides and advisors, and because it was really stemming from the sense of feeling of anxiety that he was inadequate. Now, part of it was justified, and part of that was exacerbated. So, anyways, the key point here is that the Megillah is an unbelievable story of understanding the limiting beliefs that the wicked person has, whether it be Achashverosh or Haman, and the exalted healthfulness and wisdom that our hero and heroine, which is Mordechai and Esther, have to be able to navigate very stressful circumstances, is, you know, when you have the entire Jewish people on your shoulders. So you have Portraits of Greatness, that's Mordechai and Esther first, Mordechai number two. And Portraits of failure of varying degrees of Haman and Achashverosh. And the aspect that we focus on today was really Achashverosh's overwhelming sense of neediness that animated him, A, killing his wife, B, needing to have such a powerful number two telling him what to do about everything. And when Haman says, kill all the Jews, says, okay. He didn't say, well, why don't we do an investigation to see if you're claims against the Jews are justified. He does not do that. He hands them the ring, and then, of course, the Jews get, the fear of a genocide occurs to them. So the story, the Megillah is, it has endless lessons for us to live our life better and to appreciate. Ultimately, it's a celebration of Hashem's goodness to the Jewish people, that even with all the wise plans that Esther and Mordechai did, Hashem assisted them, partnered with them to bring a salvation to the Jewish people, which is the cause behind our epic celebration, which we're going to have next Monday night and Tuesday. So I wish everybody a Purim Sameach, and everybody should get into the Purim spirit of things. And I will be Monday night at MG, of course, with a Purim costume, which I have to figure out what I'm doing, and working on it. And well, if I see you guys, we'll have a L'chaim.
Great. I have one question. Shabbat. Can you include alcohol in your gift baskets, or does it have to be two food items?
The Rambam has it says two. The level is depending. Again, it's all relative to what the person likes. But it's two kinds of meat, two kinds of cooked dishes, or two kinds of foods, and foods includes beverages. Okay. So according to some, it's about enhancing the Purim Suda. So, you know, like a person adds a bottle of wine, that adds to the Suda. I mean, you know, but many people like go with a dessert part, you know, cookies and cakes and hamantash and that kind of stuff, the dessert component. Yeah. But a higher quality, in other words, you can also stagger them. You can have, like, to your good friend, you give them like the best shalachmanas with two kinds of meat, like a let's say a sandwich, or, you know, like a steak sandwich or something like that, and something else, and wine or whatever. One pastrami, one corned beef. That's a cool Purim Suda. That would be an epic, again, not to a vegan, obviously. That would not appreciate. But to a person who is a regular meat-eating Jew, which is, I think, most Jews, that would be like the epic Purim. That would be like the Hall of Fame Shalach Manas. Because they can literally, it's a Purim Suda in a basket. And then, and then from there, down to an orange and an apple. You know what I mean? Like,
I'm looking at Girl Scout cookies and miniatures of whiskey.
That works. That works. That would augment anybody's Suda. Sounds delightful.
Hey, they're in their
cookies and whiskey.
That's it, baby.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, we have a kosher Girl Scout troop here. So I had to buy from all the people in the community. So I have like 15 boxes of Girl Scout cookies. I'm like,
perfect.
Get rid of them before Pesach. So
there you go.
I never really looked until this year that like Girl Scout cookies are certified by the OU.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Being that, and now that certification is paying both of our salaries, so we are all in favor of that. So all right.
That's why we have a kosher Girl Scout troop in Las Vegas.
That's beautiful. All right, guys. So wish you know funny. Guys.
Rabbi.
Yes.
At the start of class, you mentioned that Megillat Esther is, I believe, your favorite in Tanakh. Why is that?
Because it has great great characters, and it has working out all the dynamics. You know, this is just two of the Midrashim. There's an entire world of Midrash surrounding and a God around it, which shows profound insight about the human personality. We just picked up one element of the human personality. There are many, many more. So it's a gift that keeps on giving. That's my short answer.
It's the only one that's going to exist after Mashiach comes.
Right. Well, this is basically. Or we're going to publicly continue to read. In other words, other Nevi'im and the Ketuvim, which like the Haftorahs, are not going to be read. But McGill's Esther is going to be read forever. That's a sheer in its own right. But we are way over time, so we're not going to go into that. But that's a juicy statement of the Talmud that's worthy of unpacking an entire sheer. So I'm not going.
Why does the master of the universe want the story to never go extinct? Dun, 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 dun.
That's it. Okay, guys. Till next time.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thanks, Rabbi.